Welcome to the Beamsville Church of Christ online ministry. This week's message is titled, Jesus Cares. Thank you to Earl, Amy, Paul, and Heather for being involved in the service. Happy birthday this week to Ruth, and happy anniversary to Lynn and Dave, and to Kathy and Earl.
Good day. So, how many avid RPG players do we have here? What? No one's into Zelda? Oh, even saying Zelda, I'm 20 years out of date, or 30 years out of date. There's open world games, so games in which they give you an entire sort of universe to play in. And there's a storyline that you follow, but there's lots of things you can do, just everywhere. There's two types of players. There's the people who go and do the things you need to do to win. So go to the village, get the weapon, defeat the bad guy, win. And then there's the people that do all the other stuff along the way. Go and talk to this guy, find his lost shoe, go over here, fulfill this quest, side quests. Do all the little thing, get all the little rewards along the way. Okay, maybe that's not helpful. What about doing research? Does anyone relate to me on this? You're looking something up on the internet. You know, somebody's asked a question, you're trying to figure something out, you're on Wikipedia, and you're like, what is the wingspan of the African swallow? There's a reference for you. And you're on Wikipedia, and you're looking at it, and there's something over there that you could click on that's a little, like, it's not really about that, but it's about something else. And you're like, what about the North American swallow? I hadn't thought about that, and then you click on that. And then 3 minutes later, you're clicked on another thing, and now you're looking up the GDP of Germany. Do you do that? Okay, well, what about, and this one's perhaps more particular to me, in my new job, I do a lot of figuring out how much something is worth. So someone's been in an accident, someone's had some property damage, and we're trying to figure out how much to pay, how much to offer to settle, that kind of thing. And I have a giant list of documents, you know, invoices, doctor's reports, blah, blah, blah. And I'm supposed to come up with some sort of number. And I'm going through them all, and I'm trying to figure out what is important and what isn't. So there's the big things, right? So if it's an injury, you know, the surgeries or lifelong compensation, blah, blah, blah. If it's a property damage, it's how much it is to rebuild, blah, blah, blah. But then there's all these other things in the notes. Well, this was reported lost in the fire. And it's brought up several times. Oh, okay, well, then I put a bunch of research into figuring out what it is and how much replacement value. It's $25. They paid more for me to look that up than the insurance company would if they just paid it without any research whatsoever. But perhaps even more so that you might identify with, tomorrow morning, Heather and I and Ellis are going on our once-a-year big, long camping trip. So we're driving up past Sudbury for our first camping spot, and then down to Algonquin, and then up north of North Bay, and then back home. Where, if you plot out those dots on the map, we're making the most inefficient route as possible. So win. Are you the type of traveler that when you start out, you have your destination, and you just go? You go, you stop for gas, you maybe stop for food, stop for the washroom, that's it. Or you're driving along, that's an interesting sign. Let's go check that out. Or, you know what, I've never been down that road before. I wonder what's down there. Heather and I have different opinions about this. Can you guess? Which is which? I am definitely the meander through the countryside, look at all the stuff, stop 50 million times, you know, get our third drink along the way. Heather is, we're not there yet. Why aren't we there yet? Let's get there yet. I have an opinion, but Heather's right. So today we're going to talk about, as Amy talked about, God's attention on us, God's focus on us. Even when the main quest, the main job, the main goal is this, he turns his attention to me. So we're going to look at scriptures and look several narratives where Jesus does just that. There are bigger things going on. There are bigger threats going on. And Jesus takes the time to stop and deal with the person in front of him. So first, to start off with, this may be something that we might face a lot in life. In John 2, 1 through 12, we're going to read some narratives. We're not going to look in depth at them, but we're going to look at the attention Jesus plays and the fact that he stops and looks. So you may be familiar with this. John 2, starting at verse 1, on the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood six stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn it the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink, but you've saved the best till now." In this case, it seems like this is an inconvenience. Jesus is doing his early ministry. They're going to this wedding. There's a problem at the wedding. The caterers haven't brought enough stuff. This is the great nightmare of wedding planning, right? And Jesus' mother says, "Help this bridegroom out." And Jesus says, "Okay, fine." And he changes the water into wine. For whatever reason, it doesn't seem like Jesus wants to be involved in this. It's not convenient. It's not the right time. It's not the right place. But he does it anyway. In our lives, probably most of the time, that is the sort of area of attention where we can get tripped up in. It's inconvenient. I'm going through my life. I'm doing the things I need to do. I'm going to work. I'm getting supper ready. I'm paying attention to this, or I'm focusing on that. And some opportunity comes up, and it's inconvenient. It's just I have other things that I need to be doing. It's not like they're super important, but I'm just busy with something. I had a professor at Harding who would acknowledge that his own personality was just someone who was zero focused in on doing the next thing. And he had trouble even seeing those opportunities pop up because he was focused on doing the next thing. And he would say that he had to train himself to stop and say, "No, stop. Pay attention to this, and then move on to the next thing." But there's more serious consequences. Mark chapter 2. Here we have some cultural, theological, and political threats to Jesus as he encounters someone. Mark chapter 2, starting at verse 13. "Once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. 'Follow me,' Jesus told him. And Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, 'Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?' On hearing this, Jesus said to them, 'It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call on the righteous, but the sinners.'" In that day and time, Israel is a conquered state by the Romans. The way that they did taxes, they didn't send out income tax every year or pay GST on everything. What they had was tax collectors. So people who would sit at a booth, people would go by, and they would tax things you're bringing and going, commerce, that kind of thing. And the way that the tax collector would make money is by if they could get a little extra. So their wage came out of, well, the tax is 10%, But if I think I can get 15% out of you, then that's how I make money. So on two fronts, tax collectors are bad. They work for the Romans, the conquerors. And two, they steal your money. Which is worse? That's a toss-up. Here Jesus sees a tax collector, Levi, says, follow him, which already is a dangerous thing to do. If you want to be popular in Israel, you don't go be friends or have followers, disciples from the tax collectors. Then he goes, eats at his house with his friends. The tax collectors, because of who they are, the business they're in, who they work for, their friend group isn't the good, upstanding Jewish folk. Their friend group is the people that are on the margins of society, as the text says, the sinners. And Jesus has dinner with these folks, and the Pharisees look on and say, is this really a good idea? Are we really sure that you should be doing this? Rabbi, teacher, you should be associating with these people? Culturally, this was the wrong thing to do. Politically, this was the wrong thing to do on the side of the Romans, potentially. Theologically, these are sinners. These are not upstanding, God-fearing Jewish folk. These are people that we don't associate with, and yet Jesus does it anyway. John 4, starting at verse 1. Now Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that he was gaining and baptizing more disciples than John, although in fact it was not Jesus who baptized, but his disciples. So he left Judea and went back once more to Galilee. Now he had gone through Samaria, so he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When the Samaritan woman came to draw water. Pause there. Okay, we're in Samaria. Samaria, Israel is weird. Every place is weird, but if you think about it. But Israel's weird in that it's kind of in two bits. There's Judea to the south and Galilee to the north. In between is Samaria. Samaria is sort of the stepbrother. They're very close, culturally, religiously, in a lot of different ways, but they're not quite the same. And if you have, who has siblings? Okay. How energetic are your fights with your siblings? The closer you are in relationship, the more energy you have the argument about, right? This is how it was with Samaritans and the Jews. They were very close in a lot of ways, and they were also passionately against each other. So Jesus is already in Samaria. You're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to go around. You're supposed to walk all the way around. He's already in Samaria, so that's already a problem. But now he is at a well, and a Samaritan woman comes to draw water. Did anyone catch what time the Samaritan woman came to draw water? Noon. Now, given summer, noon is the hot time. If you're going to fetch water, you don't go at noon. You go in the morning, you go in the evening, when carrying a bunch of water back and forth between the well and your home isn't so strenuous. The woman is going to fetch water at noon because no one else is there. So we already know something's up. Put that in your mind. The woman said to him, you are a Jew, and I'm a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it was and who it is who that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him and he would give you living water. Sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well to drink it from, as did his sons and his livestock? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up in life. Already, early on, we have Jesus asking someone he shouldn't be talking to, both because of ethnicity, Samaritan and Jew, also man and woman, and also, as we'll hear more details later, probably social issues going on. But even in that conversation of hey, can I have some water? She very quickly brings up the fact that, oh, how about a contentious religious debate? You know, I'm going to bring up the fact that this is Jacob's well in Samaria that we have particular value with. Are you going to go against this thing, Mr. Jew person? Already the ratchet is going up in the conversation. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. He told her, go, call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you have now is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. If you go to any soft skills seminar, like how to talk to people, you're not supposed to do this. This is a whole other... The other stuff was minefields. This is a different minefield entirely that you shouldn't be going into. And yet Jesus does. Sir, I can see you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. You can kind of see her backing away. Let's get more to an argument that I can win, or at least I think I can win, where we should worship properly. That's a safer topic. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me, the time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation comes from the Jews. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit. His worshipers must worship in spirit and truth. The woman said, I know that Messiah, called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, am he. But notice this. Just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. But no one asked, what do you want or why are you talking with her? The list of threats here to Jesus is long. Ethnic, religious, cultural, political. Even, although his disciples don't say anything, his own disciples are a little taken aback by what Jesus is doing here. Why are you talking to this person? We shouldn't be talking to this person. And yet Jesus does. He takes the time. He could have said, give me some water. She could have said what she did, either given him water or not, and that could have been it. But instead, Jesus takes the time. He goes into the minefields. And we'll come back to the rest of that story later. John 8, chapter 1. Verse 1. Here we have a situation where Jesus is threatened by the leadership, what we might call influencers. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to them, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now, what do you say? They were using this question as a trap in order to have the basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said, let any one of you who is without sin be the first one to throw the stone at her. Then he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left. And the woman still standing there, Jesus straightened up and asked her, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you. Now go, leave your life of sin. In this case, Jesus the Pharisees confront Jesus. They bring a posse. It's a trap. So they bring a woman caught in adultery, or at least they say caught in adultery. The law says we should stone her. They know Jesus is compassionate. They know Jesus tends to have unusual answers to the rules. And so they challenge him. What do you do? Are you going to go against the law? And Jesus gives them a question back that they're unable to answer, and it disarms them, and they disperse. One of the things that I found new about this story that I hadn't quite thought about before, Jesus is surrounded by a group of people who are ready to stone someone. Physical violence is on the table. I mean, they're intending on killing this woman right then and there. And he is also in that circle. The potential for physical violence to him is not zero. So not only is he going against the religious leaders, political leaders of the day, he's also making a pretty big risk of his own life. If he straight up and said, "No, I refuse to enforce the law," what do you think those Pharisees would have done next? I mean, best case scenario, they would have hauled him off to court. But they're sitting there holding stones. I don't know for sure, but I think the threat is there. The fact that he stops, he puts his own neck on the line, whatever percentage of danger is there, for this woman who he's never met before, who might have been guilty of the charge. But he does it anyway. Our final text that we'll look at this morning, Luke 23, starting at verse 32, and then we'll jump to 39. Two other men, both criminals, were also laid out with him to be executed. So Jesus is on the cross, or about to be on the cross. When they come to the place called the Skull, they crucified him there, Jesus, along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him, "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said to them, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Why do I bring up this example? I mean, Jesus isn't on his way anywhere. The bad thing has already happened. Ultimately, the good thing. But the sequence of events is put in play now. But what I get stuck on is Jesus is kind of busy right now. Without going into every detail, every breath he is taking on that cross is a huge amount of effort. Every word he gets out is a monumental amount of effort. He could very easily have just let the criminals be. You know, they can waste their breath. The one guy can waste his breath on this. He doesn't need to engage. He's got bigger things going on, literally, physically, in his body at the moment. And yet, he stops. He takes care with the criminal. He says, "You know, you're right." And he assures him in his literal dying moment that he will be in paradise with him. He does the most comforting thing you can possibly do, even at the pain and expense of himself in that moment. One of the things that I have often struggled with is the difference between knowing a thing is true and feeling a thing is true. Do you understand the difference between a thing? You can know something is true, but sometimes it's hard to feel that it's true. In a classic example, and I don't bring this up to be controversial, but it's a good way to illustrate it, is in study after study after study in North America, if you ask people straight up, right in front of their face, "Should you be racist?" Vast majority of people say, "No. You know, we know that you shouldn't. We know you should treat everybody the same. We know that you should give people the same opportunity, etc." We can argue about what those details are, but most people know that and are willing to admit it and agree with it. But study after study also shows that if you don't ask them straight up, but rather observe or give them scenarios and let their subconscious do the thinking, they often make different choices. There's a difference between knowing and feeling. And what I would suggest is we can sometimes have that same difference in faith. We can know faith, agree with our faith 100%, but sometimes not necessarily feel the faith. So I was baptized. Oh, I didn't think about the year. Some time ago, when I was 14 in the 90s. We went up north to my mother and her family. The Hotchkisses lived in Dwight. Anyone know where Dwight is? Near Dorset, north of Halliburton. There is a historic fire tower up there. I have a weird fear of heights. I don't know if anybody has the same thing as me. I can go up as far as you want me to go up if I can't see through the thing I'm walking on. Even if it's rotted out wood, if it's all there, fine, happy. If you can see through it, so you know those stairs that have the metal with the holes in them? You can see through them? Yeah, can't do it. I don't know why, it doesn't make sense, but that's just one of my weird things. We're going up to the top of this fire tower, and I get about halfway up, and I just stop. I can't do it anymore. And I'm sitting there on one of the landings, and I'm just mad at myself because I can't go any further. Why can't I go any further? And I start doing the logic loop in my head. Well, you can't go any further because you're afraid you're going to fall off. Well, why am I afraid I'm going to fall off? I grew up in the church. I've heard many sermons, some pretty good. And I go, well, if I fall off, I'll die. Why is that a problem? Well, because I know I'm not saved. Well, Paul, you could solve this problem if you wanted to. Do you really want to? And that was the point where I said, yeah, I kind of want to. So we went home and did it. It became real to me. I knew all the details before that, but I didn't feel it until then. What might happen in our lives when we receive the type of attention that God can offer to us, that same type of attention that Jesus offered to all those people? One bit is the last part of John 4, the Samaritan woman. John 4, 28, then leaving her water jar, this is directly after she's talked to Jesus, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? They came out of the town and made their ways toward him. Many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me everything I ever did. So the Samaritans came to him. They urged him to stay with him. He stayed 2 days, and because of his words, many more became believers. Lest we forget, who is the Samaritan woman? Even amongst her own people, she probably wasn't that popular. She was going for water at noontime when nobody else was there. She had a checkered history, and she is the one who goes and basically converts her town. She introduces Jesus to her town, gets them to come. Jesus talks to them. There is a chance, if we accept this love of God, this individual, personal love of God, that we will engage in ministry. Also, in Luke 2, in Levi, we have the ministry. Levi joins Jesus, becomes one of the 12, is very involved in his ministry, but also he finds redemption. In Luke 8, the woman who was caught in adultery finds redemption, and of course the criminal on the cross finds redemption. There are two predictable applications here, ministry and redemption, but there's also perhaps a more fundamental, more unpredictable application. The idea that God truly, specially, specifically cares about you and me. And it can lead to places that are hard to predict. The motivator that God positively finds attention to us can be very powerful. In our text, Levi leaves his profession, leaves the tax collector business, and becomes one of the 12. The Samaritan woman goes from intentionally going to the well alone to talking to an entire town. What in your and my life could use that positive godly attention, that sort of power, energy, comfort, and love? As you may know, I've been on a journey learning the feel of the love of God. I've known the love of God, but struggled to feel it. This perhaps is an area where the motivator most applies to me. But there is an unsurprising pattern in Scripture about ministry. What God wants to do through us, he first wants to do in us. Ministry, evangelism, service, outward expressions of love of Christ is the same energy and direction and motivation as those things applied to my personal faith. Acceptance of the positive individual attention of God in my life means that it will eventually, in some way, reflect on those around me. For those of you who are science-y, we're like some sort of 3D shape with mirrors on the inside, with a hole on one side. It could be a sphere or some other shape. Light comes into that hole, bounces all inside, and then eventually, as things move and change, it'll eventually bounce out through the hole. Just like our lives accepts the light of God, it'll reflect in us over and over again, and as we shape change, it eventually bounces out towards someone else. May we individually accept this attention of God and see in general, see redemption in ministry, but also perhaps unpredictable specific results in our lives. God offers this attention to you and to me today. He offers to those around you and me today, and through you to those people around us today as well. What would it look like to accept that attention in our individual lives, to our personal faiths this week or even today? What would it look like to express that attention of God to those around us this week or even today as we leave today?
Thanks for watching or listening. The Beamsville Church of Christ meets at 4900 John Street, Beamsville, Ontario. Scripture quotations marked NIV, taken from the Holy Bible, New International Version, NIV. Copyright 2011 by Biblica, Inc. Used by permission, all rights reserved worldwide. You can learn more about the congregation on our Facebook page or at beamsvillechurchofchrist.ca.